We'll call the House Tax Committee to order, please.
You hurt your pride more than you do anything else.
We'll have the secretary take the roll call, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fielder.
Excused.
Chair Welch.
Here.
Vice Chair Thane.
Here.
Representative Vinton.
Excused.
Representative Abbott.
Excused.
Representative R. Knudsen.
Here.
Representative T. Smith.
Present.
Representative Romano.
Here.
Representative Niklokakos.
Here.
Representative Miner.
Here.
Representative Marler.
Excused.
Representative Malone.
Here.
Representative Kearns.
Here.
Representative Kazmaier.
Here.
Representative Fern.
Here.
Representative Essman.
Here.
Representative Konauer.
Excused.
Representative Butcher.
Here.
Representative Buckley.
Here.
Representative Brewster.
Here.
Representative Barker.
Here.
Mr. Chair, 16 members are present. 5 are excused.
Thank you. We've got 4 bills this morning. We'll get through those. Tentatively, if you want to look up there, just want to make sure committee's aware of what we're looking at. Those are tentative, but to give you an idea, the big thing I want you to realize is that we haven't been meeting on Mondays, but because we're losing at least one day next week due to House Bill 2, we will meet on Monday. Is the tentative plan for now, so we'll see what happens. So. No, I'm not asking. I am telling. I just think that's, you know, to stay on top of things with the number of bills we got and losing at least one morning next week, I think we need to get that done. So I made that decision. I don't get to make them very often, so thank you. So, okay, I would remind those in the audience, usual protocol, please spell your last name for us if we don't already have it. Please identify yourself. Cell phones, please turn off. If you have to take a call, please step out. We'll get through these. We do have, like I say, a number of bills, so we'll get started. And our first bill this morning is Senate Bill 3 with Senator Cuff. You ready, Senator Cuff? We'll start the hearing on Senate Bill 3.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Members of the, and Mr. and Ms. Members of this Taxation Committee. Thank you for getting me on early this morning. And I am here to present Senate Bill 3, which I had thought would be on the governor's desk by now, but it's here today, and it's a very important bill. And I appreciate the time that you will give us. This bill of all I'm carrying this session, and maybe all almost of everything I've carried, is the nearest to my heart. I think the most important for my country and the country of a number of you folks on the committee and in the House. This has to do with providing jobs and a way of life in our timbered areas of Montana. And it's not just my district, but my district, this is extremely vital. We've lost most of our timber, logging, milling jobs, and I used to earn my living that way, and I had a pretty good retirement coming, and it disappeared. Sometimes I resent that, but that doesn't pay off to worry about what didn't happen. This bill has to do with what it takes to run a mill. When you talk about jobs, most people don't think about where does the product come from, the raw material coming into the mill. And as we ran our mills, and I worked for big companies and I worked for small company. And mills die hard, but they do die from lack of timber. Now, we had a million acres of land. And the point being is that this bill addresses very particular a bunch of that land and a whole lot of other. We're talking about private land, private timberland. And we often say that timber is a crop. Logs are a crop, and they are. But they're very slow-growing crop. And typically, I think the Forest Service definition is if an area is clear-cut, it takes at least 70 years before that's considered a forest again, even though it's growing trees all that time, but it's not considered a mature forest for at least 70 years. Now, to run a mill, we needed X amount off federal land. We counted on X amount off our own private land and other private land, state land, and their bigger timberland owners. Between Kalispell, I'm going to give you an example, between Kalispell and Libby and Thompson Falls, there are vast tracts of the timberland that used to belong to the company that I worked for. And I paid for my kids, their shoes, the table, the college. And then my retirement was coming next, and the mill disappeared before we got there. That timberland eventually was sold to Plum Creek, who cut it hard, and they sold to Weyerhaeuser. And then Weyerhaeuser has chunked off between Plum Creek and Weyerhaeuser some major tracts, major pieces of that land have broken up into very sizable pieces. And we have at least one of those landowners with us today. It's a company called Green Diamond, which I never heard of until the last few years. And they had bought a sizable portion. Now imagine if you have a company or a family with money to invest, and you invest it in a property, and then you get your tax bill, and you bought it anticipating the tax is this level, whatever, say it's $1 an acre, and all of a sudden the tax bill comes, it's actually $3 an acre, or whatever the amount would be. It was going to triple 2 years ago when we came into this session. Timber owners came to me out of 150 legislators. I'm the last timber beast. And I'm not a tax guy. I've always been an appropriations kind of a guy. At any rate, Becky Beard passed it off to me to carry to fix it. And she worked with me. You may remember, we created a special committee. We spent time studying it. It was a really good committee, and we went in throwing bricks at each other and calling each other names. By the time it was done, everybody felt super good. And they were practically singing Kumbaya. We'll have folks here from Department of Revenue who did a great job working this thing out. This tax is similar to what you do with agricultural land. But the big difference is the tax is spread out over 7 years. As an example, if you have, let's say you have 300 acres and you got 100 acres you logged last year and you logged it heavy, whether you clear cut or you logged it hard. You have one beside it that is you're going to go into this year. And yet the next one down, maybe you logged 20 years ago. What's your tax going to be? Well, it's going to be the same on each one of those segments because the tax is prorated out over 70 years with various adjustments along the way. Whether you call it inflation cost, whatever the reason, it's to keep up with what the real world world is. That's what we worked on. It's been done before. We think we got it really good now. We're proposing a 2-year cycle instead of a 6-year cycle because part of what happened, the institutional knowledge of how you do this, people don't understand it, and it's complicated. DNRC, they really did a good job. Timber companies, They were bulldogs in there staying with it. And I'm proud of the package we came out with. It sets, it's a two-stage process for implementing the current tax. And then it's on a revolving cycle. And the committee will meet every 2 years to tune it up as we need to go. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to, I think, Department of Revenue will take it first. I'm so proud that I got to be able to work with these guys.
Thank you, Senator Cuff. Proponents?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Scott Mendenhall, M-E-N-D-E-N-H-A-L-L, Deputy Director, Department of Revenue. And good to be with you this morning. We just want to say thank you for your work on behalf of citizens and taxpayers. I know there's a lot goes into this, and I appreciate your sacrifice and your time. I wanted to advocate for this process, and I think there's applications for it in other complicated tax situations. This is very similar, this Forest Lands Advisory Tax, Forest Lands Taxation Advisory Commission in statute is similar to your interim committee work, except for some differences. It's attached to the DOR for administration, and the advantage of that is that avails this commission to the work of our tax policy and research division. There's some people here, amazing group of economists that can do work. And in fact, we brought in this, in and through this bill, we brought something that had been outsourced at the U of M in-house. And so we save about $10,000 of outsourcing cost. And that brings certainty, predictability to that analysis part of that. I think that's good. And also, being in-house, it avails the committee to the people that are in the field actually doing this assessment, the property assessment division. So I think that there's some other things. You might hear about this in other ways, such as central assessment, refineries, maybe telecom. Those sorts of more complicated issues, I think, would be very well served by this same style of interim work that can bring something that's contentious to rest in and through a process of consensus and also collaboration. People come into this with the idea of we need to solve this. And so I commend this this bill to you in that regard. This does put it on a two-year cycle that aligns this up with other types of property assessment. Finally, I just want to say thanks to those of you that came over and took advantage of our briefing sessions. I think it was very productive. And if you have any interest in doing that, we're willing to do that at any time. So if you want to learn more about anything to do with the Department of Revenue, the things that we do, give us a holler. We're happy to sit down and visit with you about that at any time. So we have some people here from the Property Assessment Division and also the Tax Policy and Research Division that will answer your questions, further inform you on this. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Next proponent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Bryce Kautz, that's K-A-A-T-Z, Bureau Chief with the Property Assessment Division. Kind of echo some of the things the Deputy Director said. We just really want to thank all the members of the advisory committee that engaged with us over the interim to work on this taxation of forest land. So this really stemmed from actually last session, two bills that were passed in the 2021 session, Senate Bill 262, which basically mandated that the Forest Land Taxation Advisory Committee get together and do a really good in-depth analysis of how we tax forest land. And then a companion bill to that was Senate Bill 263, which adjusted the tax rates downward on forest land to keep it taxable value neutral with what it was last cycle. So that was kind of the beginning point for our work here. We met with the committee, worked with them closely over the interim, probably 10 to 15 total meetings between the whole committee and a subcommittee. And out of that work, evaluating all the aspects of forest land taxation, that committee came up with five recommendations that they made to the Revenue Interim Committee and that are found in this bill. And I'll just kind of briefly walk you through what those five recommendations were and the five things that this bill will ultimately do. As was mentioned, historically, back in 2015 is when the state moved from a six-year reappraisal cycle to the two-year reappraisal cycle. That was done for Class 4 property and Class 3 agricultural property. At that time, Class 10 forest land remained on the six-year cycle. So the first recommendation that came out of the work of this committee was to move forest land to a two-year cycle, just like all the other property types went to in 2015. With that, the second piece out of that Senate Bill 263 last session, that adjustment in tax rate for forest land was only a two-year adjustment to get us through the work of this interim committee evaluate what those recommendations were. Just timing-wise, with this bill just now being heard, we're right in the middle of our reappraisal work. There just simply wasn't time to wait to see if this bill passed or not and implement all the work that's required to move to the two-year cycle this year. So that's why beginning in 2025 is when forest land will go to the two-year cycle. So again, to accommodate those 2 years, the second thing this bill does is adjust those tax rates downward again for the next 2 years to remain taxable value neutral for that Class 10 property type. The third recommendation kind of mirrors how we value ag land, and that was to go to a 10-year Olympic average for the productivity value calculation for forest land. You know, an Olympic average is just you throw out the high value, the low value, and average the remaining. So that was the third recommendation. The fourth recommendation, as was briefly mentioned, one of the drawbacks of the six-year cycle and that Forest Land Taxation Advisory Committee is that they would only meet once every 6 years. You would have quite a bit of turnover on that committee. It's pretty hard to remember what you talked about 6 years, so a lot of that initial work is just trying to get everyone up to speed and educated on how forest land is valued in the state. So the fourth recommendation was that that committee is to meet annually, just to keep that knowledge up, apprised of what changes we're seeing, address any issues or concerns that committee has. And then the last recommendation that was touched on too is, in the past, we would always contract with a professor from the University of Montana to come up and calculate what the productivity values for our forest zones were in, for each cycle. With that committee, they had a few concerns with how those calculations were done. We took a good hard look at that. We made the determination that our tax policy and research division was more than capable of doing those calculations. So we've moved those from having to contract with the University of Montana to doing those calculations internally with our tax policy and research division. One, it saves us some money. Two, working with the committee, we were able to address some of the concerns with that initial model. Our tax policy and research was able to make some tweaks to those formulas at the request of the Forest Lands Taxation Advisory Committee. So it produces what they felt and we felt is a better, more accurate valuation. And as we meet with this committee, it gives us more flexibility to go in and make those adjustments and not have to rely on doing a contract or an amendment to that contract. So really, those are the five things that were recommended from that committee and the five items that this bill is addressing. And again, we just really want to thank everyone who participated on that committee, worked closely with us. I think we have a good product, and we'll be more than happy to try to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room?
Mr. Chair, my name is Randy Mannix, M-A-N-N-I-X. I'm from Helmville, a private landowner. I also served on the Forest Lands Advisory Taxation Committee. Myself, along with my brothers and our families, we operate the Mannix Brothers Ranch in northern Powell County. And the forest land is a significant component of our ranch. Besides providing revenue from timber sales through the years, it also provides grazing and wildlife habitat as well as clean water. A well-managed forest is resistant to disease, insect, and wildfire. It's important that forest lands taxes are based on values that our forest lands owners can realistically expect from the sale of timber. Tax values should help encourage sustainable forest management and not make landowners feel like they have to overcut their forest. This bill helps do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mannix. Further proponents?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Callahan. That's C-A-L-L-A-H-A-N. And I work for the Green Diamond Resource Company that Senator Cuff referenced. We're a fifth-generation company that owns, recently bought 291,000 acres in Lincoln, Sanders, and Flathead counties. We bought them at the end of 2020 as a generational investment for the company. These lands had changed hands quite often over the last few decades, or decade, as Senator Cuff referenced. We plan to be in Montana for a long time on the land. Our current company president, he would like to see his grandchildren, when they run the company, manage his lands. His kids are only in middle school, so he's already thinking about his grandkids. When we think about staying on the lands and what it takes to stay in the lands, stay active, stay successful in forestry, four main things we need to worry about. We have to have access to markets, we have to have a vibrant workforce, predictable regulations, and an equitable tax system. Obviously, today, the first three isn't before you, but that fourth one is an equitable tax system. A bill like this allows companies like Green Diamond to stay on the land, continue to produce logs for the mills, pay our taxes, create economic activity, have open space, have habitat, and create recreational activities for the people in our communities. And this bill will help us do that. Be happy to have answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Callahan. We'll get to questions later. Thank you. Next proponent.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julia Altemus. That's A-L-T-E-M-U-S. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Wood Products Association. But I want to thank the sponsor and the Department of Revenue for their hard work, and also for Mr. Mannix and Representative Marler, who also sits on the advisory committee. They did a lot of work over the interim to pull this bill together and what you see before you. I'm going to give you a little bit broader overview of what the bill or what this does for us. So Montana is host to over almost 4 million acres of private timberland, of which approximately 850,000 acres are private industrial timberlands, and so those are the lands that the Montana Wood Products Association represents. The industrial timberlands are not only open to the public under block management for hunting and recreation, they're also working forests and the wood basket for the companies that own them and the wood manufacturers that rely on these lands to be sustainably managed for present and future timber harvest. As you know, unlike agricultural lands that are on a 1 or 2 year crop rotation, forest lands take decades to reach a stage of growth where timber harvest is an option. During this time, owners of the forested lands work to maintain healthy forests, pay taxes, and hope they do not lose their assets to wildfire. To be identified as Class 10 timberlands, the Department of Revenue evaluates the ownership, land use, tree species, stocking rate, productivity, area, and accessibility, and measures the potential productivity of the land and not the actual productivity of the land. Because valuing timberlands is complex, the Forest Land Taxation Advisory Committee was formed to review the inputs to the appraisal model the department relies on and to advise the department changes in condition and market value and other modeling factors. Again, we support the work that they have done. This is really important because without this, the more constraints you put on these timberland owners, they're likely to make different decisions in the future because they do have a bottom line. And they're here for the long run, but they need your help to be in an equitable tax situation. So we would ask that you support the bill, and wanted to let you know the chamber was going to be here, but they were called to a different meeting and wanted me to do a Me Too for them as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Bob Story, STORY, Montana Taxpayers Association. We support the bill also. I think the proponents have pretty well explained what it do, but just the basics of taxes, a stable, predictable tax system is important to everyone, and especially in the forest industry, because unlike agriculture, determining the value of a log and the product, a wood product, is a lot more difficult than determining the value of wheat or hay, because you don't have nearly as transparent a market system. You don't have the hundreds or thousands of people buying and selling, and you don't have the data that's collected daily in those agricultural markets and the timber market. So that's what's important. You have this advisory committee put together so that they can sit down with the department and work out the issues of what is the true value of logs, what's the productivity of land, and all those issues that are pretty technical that the industry need to be involved in. And those of you that were here a couple of years ago when this first came forward, the breakdown was that that advisory committee wasn't involved in the last reappraisal cycle very much. And so the department's committed to get involved with that, and now that more work is done in-house, I think the department and the industry will be able to work together, and hopefully we won't have problems in this situation in the future. So we support the bill and hope you do too.
Thank you, Mr. Story. Further proponents in the room? Proponents in the room? Do we have proponents online, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Paul McKenzie.
Mr. McKenzie.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul McKenzie. That's McKenzie. I'm the Vice President and General Manager for FH Stoltzland and Lumber Company up in Columbia Falls. And I also served 2 years on the forest, or for two terms on the Forest Lands Taxation Committee. Stoltz is a 111-year-old family-owned forest management and lumber manufacturing company. We operate a sawmill with about 120 direct employees. We produce about enough lumber to build 5,000 homes a year. We also have a biomass-fired cogeneration facility that powers about 2,500 homes. We also own and manage about 38,000 acres of timberland, about a third of which is under long-term conservation easements, ensuring long-term production of forest products, including clean air, clean water, healthy wildlife habitat, and recreational opportunities. And we'd like to be able to keep doing what we've been doing for the last 111 years, which is growing trees and taking care of forests, while meeting the demands of society for our renewable building products and building healthy communities and healthy families at the same time. We've already heard that it takes a long time to grow a tree in Montana, and annual carrying costs like property tax really do add up over 70 years. The people of Montana decided a long time ago it's in the state's best interest to incentivize private forest landowners being managed for long-term forest management purposes. These private lands provide many benefits to the state and local communities, both economic and ecological. To that end, Montana developed the productivity-based property tax system that is equitable for forest lands. Senate Bill 3 is a result of 18 months of really hard work by the Forest Lands Taxation Advisory Committee, the Department of Revenue, and various members of the public and landowners. As was mentioned before, the 21 legislature tasked this group with reviewing the appraisal process used in Class 10 forest lands after a significantly flawed reappraisal in 2021 required short-term tax relief measures to be implemented. The department did a really good job of going over the details of what's included in Senate Bill 3, so I'm not going to do that again. But I've been personally working on Class 10 valuation problems for the last 20 years of my career. And it seems like nearly every legislative session, we've seen a bill to fix something about the valuation process. We have never in those 20 years taken as an in-depth look as we did in the last 18 months at the valuation process. With sincere effort on behalf of the department, the committee members, and the public, we feel strongly that Senate Bill 3 will provide relatively minor but durable fixes to the Class 10 appraisal process and result in a fair and equitable valuation of Class 10 forest lands that is responsive to markets and provides continual review and improvement. We encourage your support of this bill. It fixes minor problems with an otherwise sound and fair valuation methodology. And having an equitable taxation policy is critical to maintaining our private timberlands, both large and small, and encouraging landowners to conduct sustainable forest management, which supports clean air, clean water, healthy wildlife habitat, and producing the renewable building products and supporting our families and communities. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'd be glad to answer any questions, and I urge you to support Senate Bill 3.
Thank you, Mr. McKenzie. Anyone else online, please, as a proponent?
Yes, Mr. Chair. David Atkins.
Mr. Atkins, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Atkins, A-T-K-I-N-S. I'm president of the Montana Forest Owners Association and a member of the Montana Tree Farm System. I come before you today representing both of these organizations in support of Senate Bill 3. We want to really sincerely thank Senator Cuff for his sponsorship of this important bill. You have our written testimony, and I'll just highlight a few key points. We have a combined membership of approximately 500 family forest owners. So our organizations represent typically the smaller owners, you know, from 20 acres to 200 to maybe 2,000 or more acres. So we're representing over 28,000 landowners that are in this category. Our forest owners manage over 40% of Montana's productive forest land, and we provide between 30 and 50%, depending on the year, of raw materials for the wood products industry, as well as high-value wildlife habitat, clean water, and recreation opportunities for Montana citizens. Both organizations have actively participated in the Forest Land Taxation Advisory Committee and in the meetings over the last 18 months that Paul just talked about. And the Department of Revenue identified those key goals that, we all agreed to and feel that this does provide a durable process that we can rely on into the future. And so the work of the DOR, the advisory committee, the legislative interim committee, as well as our organizations representing a large segment of, the public of Montana, feel like this is a, really positive step and encourage you to pass Senate Bill 3. Thanks for the opportunity to comment, and glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Further proponents online?
Mr. Chair, there is one more. Gordy Sanders.
Mr. Sanders.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gordy Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S, resource manager for Pyramid Mountain Lumber in Seaview Lake, Montana, and a member of the Montana Forest Taxation Advisory Committee the last, for two terms. And a lot has been said. I think everybody's done a great job kind of explaining the merits of the bill. I want to thank Senator Cupp and certainly Senator Flowers, Representative Marler, and then Representative Beard, who chaired our committee this last time. And I want to thank Deputy Director Mendenhall and TPR and PAD for the great work that they've done, come a long ways. And I think we're in a great position going forward where the department will no longer be dependent upon contracting services to get this great work done. With an increased interaction between the committee members and the department, I feel very good about the future of forest land taxation from private forest landowners. Pyramid Mountain Lumber is a small family-owned mill in Seaview Lake, Montana. We have 120 to 130 employees, and we've never owned any of our own land. So we're totally dependent on all other forest landowners. Commonly, 30 to 45% of our raw materials are provided by non-industrial private forest landowners. So they are incredibly important for the great sustainable work they do on their land over time. And I'll end with that. And on behalf of our employees, thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Any more people online, pro?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Opponents in the room? Any opponents in the room? Seeing none, opponents online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Informational witnesses in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jared Isom. That's I-S-O-M. I'm an economist with the Tax Policy and Research Division at the Department of Revenue. I worked on the appraisal valuation changes in the advisory committee, and I also worked on the fiscal note, and I'm here to answer any questions you have on those.
Thank you. Further informational witnesses?
Good morning, Chair Welch, members of the committee, for the record, Corey Hoffland, first name K-O-R-Y, last name H-O-F-L-A-N-D. I'm the division administrator for the Property Assessment Division. Be glad to try to answer any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Thank you. Further informational witnesses in the room? Seeing none, informational witnesses online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Marler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, but may I speak on a point of personal privilege?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Chair, sir. I just wanted to thank everybody who was on the advisory committee for the last two interims. It was a really great group to work with. Chair Beard did a great job. I learned a lot from people on this advisory committee about private land forestry. It was a meaningful process to go through. My only regret is that we didn't come up with a good acronym for our committee, because it's a really, real big mouthful every single time you say the name of the subcommittee. And it was a great group. Thanks for being here today. Great product.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question for Mr. Callahan, Green Diamond.
Hi there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Callahan, just quickly, taxes, everybody has to pay them. Is Green Diamond participating in that carbon offset program at all to try to offset some of the taxes you have to pay?
We do. We have some of our lands enrolled in a voluntary carbon market. What that does is these lands, as Senator Cuff mentioned, were managed aggressively by the previous landowners. It's going to take a long time for those lands to come back into a rotation, healthy forestry. That takes some pre-commercial work, some investments that don't generate money. They cost money. And some of that carbon money is bridge money to help get those trees back into productive forestry and pay for the tax liability and other liabilities that come while we're waiting for those trees to become fully realized investments.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, Senator Cuff, would you like to close on your bill, please?
I will, and thank you for the serious attention that has been given. And I want to say that I enjoyed working with Representative Marler on the committee, as well as Senator Flowers from the Senate, and certainly Becky Beard, who represented it, or now Senator Beard, who chaired the committee. And it took us all. Nobody knew who was a Democrat and who wasn't. I don't think it ever crossed my mind. It was just a very good working group. And, what's the alternative? I appreciate the question on managing for carbon tax, because what it's about for me is trying to keep those lands in some semblance of what they, my dad, quite a bit, he was old by, when I was a kid, but he had pulled a crosscut on this land. I worked as for Gippo Logger, run around with a chainsaw. I managed the plywood plant in Libya, managed the sawmill, and I was partner and managed operations up in my hometown of Eureka. So the alternative, subdivide, chop it up in smaller parcels, and then none of that happens. And what else goes away is access. These folks are intending to keep it open. You could not, most of the years, didn't hardly know whether you were on private land or Forest Service land. So they're keeping fishing, hunting, logging, and wildlife management. And they're working also with all the things we deal with, like grizzly bears. So we've got a few entrepreneurs that are planning and trying to get some kind of a wood manufacturing process going again in Lincoln County. We also have some loggers that supply logs, even yet today, to Stoltz Land and Lumber. They were on the phone to some mills in Idaho, but we would like to get a few more of those jobs back in Lincoln County. And some of you we're very well aware. A couple of big operations just closed down. What it was at Livingston and Townsend, not having a mill anymore. Now I've hired. I have laid off. I guarantee you. I don't think there's anybody in this room that has laid off more people than I have. and large reason, because we shut the mills down because we didn't have timber to cut. And you haven't lived until you're looking guys and gals in the eye and saying your job is gone. The tears running down the cheek, doesn't matter. Are they 61 years old and they're not quite to retirement and those were the years they were building it up? Or are they a young newlywed that's trying to take care of a baby? That hurts, and that's where I come from. Now, we can revive it, not to the degree it was ever, but we can have some semblance and we can take care of that land in a way where we can enjoy it for recreational. Through this process, I personally have been able to establish a friendship, a trust, and kind of a business relationship, if you will, with the new owners. And I've been pleasantly surprised. You heard what he said. They got grandkids. It's a family kind of ownership. And that is pretty cool. We've also had the support of wildlife groups, DNRC, U.S. Forest Service, FWP. It's a good bill. Deputy Director Scott Mendenhall has told me the process that we did, he thinks is a model process. He'd like to see it used in other parts of the government, private interchange. With that, it is your bill now. I've tried to be as thorough. I hope I haven't gone too long. But I will tell you, I had a bill tabled in a committee last night that I didn't see it coming, and I didn't understand it, and I think part of it was didn't give enough information. Well, I think you have enough information to make a good decision today. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your attention. I want to thank all the folks that came in to support us, and see you later.
Thank you, Senator Cuff. This will close the hearing on Senate Bill 3. We'll take just a minute and get set up for the next bill, please. This one, duh. I don't know where I put it. Right down here.
You already put it on the file.
Would it be appropriate?
Yeah. Together with people like Bonnie Hamilton that works for Rice, the one that does all that kind of stuff. And so we'll get you a personal contact.
There needs to be some of that stuff in the rear brakes.
Let's start the hearing on Senate Bill 16. Senator Hertz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Greg Hertz, Senate District 6 out of Polson. Seems like I was just here yesterday. So I do have a few more bills here today. They're pretty simple. The first bill, Senate Bill 16, is at the request of the Revenue Interim Committee. And what we're doing here is we're aligning a couple of sections in the code. And in 2017, code section 1530.003, these farm and ranch accounts, in there it references 3 years. And in this section of code, it says 5 years. So first I'll maybe should explain what a farm and ranch account is and what it is not anymore, since they're no longer available. But For some time, we had in the code farmer ranch accounts, which allowed a farmer rancher to deposit money into an account up to $20,000 a year. The idea was to level out their income. They might have some income high one year, low the next year. So we were able to, you know, you could put money into these accounts. They would grow, and then when you took the money out, you had to put it into your tax return that year. So you might have had a real good year, deferred some of the income to future years, and when you had a poor year, you pulled it out of that account, you paid taxes on it. So that was a theory, but unfortunately, not very many people decided to use them. And in 2020, distributions from those accounts were $2,300. In 2021, it was $46,000. 2018, $3,400. 2019, $6,200. Not sure how many taxpayers. The number is so low, they can't disclose that due to confidentiality. I would think, based on those numbers, probably 1 to 5 taxpayers. And then additions to farm and ranch accounts, in the last 4 years, there was only one in 2018, $1,100. So in Senate Bill 399 last session that I carried, that simplified taxes, that got rid of maybe up to 15 tax credits and some deductions like this. This was one of the deductions that left. But we still have it. People still have those accounts. So when they pull money out of those, they got to pay taxes on it because they had a deduction for them previously. And all this says, like I said, it matches up with another code section to get it to 3 years. So basically, you know, as you look on line 24, if you don't take a distribution within 3 years of eligibility period, then it's going to be considered taxable income, even though you didn't take it out. So just kind of firming up these two code sections. So if you have any questions, I'm available. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hertz. Do we have proponents in the room? Proponents? Seeing none, proponents online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Opponents in the room? Opponents in the room? Seeing none, opponents online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Informational witnesses in the room? Seeing none, informational witnesses online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Questions from the committee? Representative Fern.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick one for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Do you think the lack of popularity of this program was potentially due to just more modern instruments available, or people putting stuff away in 401ks, or the other way to ask is, was this ever popular in your... It's just curious. It doesn't seem like that bad of a program.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, great question. It just didn't seem like it was ever popular. Not sure why. There's probably, like you said, there's other ways to maybe shift income around through retirement plans and other ideas. Or maybe buying equipment or stock or whatever with depreciation and all that. So,
further questions? Representative Butcher.
For the sponsor. Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's the first time I heard of this program, and I'm kind of curious whether accountants were not presenting the opportunity to their customers. They're playing other tax games instead, because it sounds like for some farmers this would be, especially in these highly fluctuating situations, this would be a good opportunity to minimize a little bit of tax load, especially during their poor years.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think the CPAs, at least the ones I know, were well aware of it. It's just, you got to remember this was only a deduction on your state tax return. So if you're going to put the full $20,000 in, you might save $1,300 in taxes, which that's a lot of money, but I'm not sure people wanted to maybe go through the hassle to do that. As Representative Fern suggested, there might have been other ways to do it. As myself, I usually try to reinvest in my company, buy some more equipment, and use the accelerated depreciation that's now available for everybody.
Further questions from the committee? Further questions? Seeing none, Senator Hertz, would you like to close on your bill?
Yes, I would. I think it's another good common sense bill from the Revenue and Income Committee, so I'd request a do pass, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hertz. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 16. And if you give us a second, we'll be ready for the next one. We'll now open the hearing on Senate Bill 54. Senator Hertz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Greg Hertz, Senate 6 again here out of Polson. This bill is at the request of the Department of Revenue and something that, you know, I fully support. I think it's a great idea. It's basically, the title says it all. It's an act revising the reappraisal cycle for certain centrally assessed property, providing for a two-year reappraisal cycle instead of annual reappraisal. So let's just talk a little bit about centrally assessed and remind everyone what that actually is. So that's a business that, you know, spans the entire state, might be a power company, might be a railroad, pipelines, things like that, that it's really hard. You can't just value them in one county. So they're valued in whole across the state. And then that centrally assessed is then divided up through the taxing jurisdictions that they belong in. So part of the problem with centrally assessed, they're fairly significant pieces of property. And what happens at times is there's an appeal process. And if these assessments are appealed, that can hold up money going to our schools and our counties and our local governments. So that creates a burden on those institutions, particularly if it's a very large amount. And there has been litigation around some centrally assessed valuations. And so what the idea here, and the problem is once you finish up 1 year, right where we're at now, and you're appealing it, you're jumping right into the next year. And so it's just kind of constantly appealing. And so the department's, you know, is wise on this. And they're like, hey, let's get on a two-year cycle. It'd be a lot easier. Maybe we get more consistency. Local governments and schools aren't going to have to worry about the appeals process and whether they're going to get their tax dollars right away. So that's kind of the whole idea. I will let the department probably walk through a little bit more of this. One thing in the Senate that we amended on page 9, the property owners were only giving 15 days once they got their notice to appeal. We moved that up to, it's kind of like a 30-day appeal process. So we got to make sure that the taxpayer has time to, you know, appeal and respond to it, but also it can't be too long. So the 30 days made sense for everybody. And then this applies to tax years beginning January 1, 2024, although you'll see there's some property on page 15 that some of this can get valued in even years and some at odd years. So those odd year properties on page 17, there's going to be a transition period for those properties. So tax year values in 2023 must be used for the tax year in 2024, adjusted for any acquisitions or dispositions of the property during the 2023 year. So it's a good bill, makes a lot of common sense. And with that, I'll take a seat and you can listen to proponents and opponents. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hertz. Proponents in the room, please. Beatty.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. My name is Brendan Beatty, B-E-A-T-T-Y. I'm the director of the Montana Department of Revenue. Before you today in support, strong support of this bill. Mr. Vice Chair, if I may, I've got a little handout here if I could hand it
up. Please.
Out. So as Senator Hertz said, this is a great bill, and I'm going to claim credit for it because, frankly, as counsel for the department for 27 years, I spent the great deal of my entire career litigating valuation and classification of centrally assessed properties. There's probably nobody else in the state besides Derek Bell, my division administrator, and myself that know more the pain associated with central assessed valuation and taxation itself. Over the course of that time, there has been tens of millions of dollars spent in litigation by both the taxpayer on the taxpayer's side and the taxpayers of the state of Montana defending and litigating centrally assessed property taxes. Now, when I took over this job, I made a pledge to you when I started that we're going to get this right. I don't care what the number is. What I care is that the Department of Revenue's estimated values of these properties is done correctly. So that's an easy thing to say. The problem is how do you do it? And I don't know about anybody else in this room, but when I've done things in a hurry, usually they didn't turn out all that good. And when I've done them under pressure, especially under a time crunch, they didn't turn out as well as they probably should have. Well, that is, in fact, exactly what our current structure is without this bill. As Senator Hertz said, every year our little crew of people there does 100 and some odd centrally assessed appraisals. And centrally assessed appraisals are very, very different than, say, a residential or a commercial property appraisal. In fact, centrally assessed appraisals are done on the value of the entity. And then you back out a bunch of intangible personal property to arrive at what this property might be worth when this property was sold to some random buyer on by some random seller on January 1 of whatever year that was, right? And so we've got this little crew of people that are trying to come up with that number. Now, this is also based on a whole bunch of information provided by the businesses. Often, there's gaps in the information or gaps in the understanding of my people of the information given them by the taxpayer. But as you can see on this little timeline I passed out, there's a very, very limited window of time for us to do our estimate of value of something the size of, say, Northwestern Energy, Montana Dakota Utilities, you name it. We asked for this information, then we've got this little crunch of time, and then we have to talk to the taxpayer and say, hey, I need this or I need that. Sometimes this and that aren't necessarily at the fingertips of the taxpayer, right? They might have to do some work to get that done. Then we issue an assessment. The taxpayer has 15 days to review how we arrived at the value of something, say, the size of a big public utility, to object to that, and then we have 15 days to arrive at a conclusion, and then it goes to litigation, or then it goes to dispute resolution, right? And I don't know how many people here have been involved in too many disputes or dispute resolution, but once you start into the word dispute, the fight's on. Regardless of how professional you are, the fight's on. So what this bill does is it actually creates a 2-year window for my people to be able to accumulate the information, talk with the taxpayer. It's amazing how much you can get done when you actually have time to talk to someone and to actually discuss the issues rather than I have 2 weeks to get a big pile of stuff and then turn around and crunch it and get something done. So by alternating between these industries, as you see in the bill, every other year, we actually have an additional year to do a better job. And frankly, I don't have a huge crew of people. And these people are highly trained, and they're hard to come by, and they're piled. And as you probably know, we're going to add more telecoms, right? There's with the broadband and all that, there's probably going to be some telecom expansion, which also adds more centrally assessed appraisals per appraiser. So the idea behind this, in short, is for us to be able to do a better job, be able to interact with the taxpayer on a much less compressed time frame, and to arrive at a value that the taxpayer and the Department of Revenue agree is 100% of market value of what that property was on the lien date. The closer we get to that, the less litigation we have. The closer we get to that, the less money there's put in protest funds in these local counties. Some counties can suck it up, but I happen to have a case once way back where 80% of the centrally assessed value of the largest taxpayer in that county was put in a protest fund. And we don't want to see that. I don't want to see that ever again. This is a way to try to preempt some of those problems. With that, Mr. Chairman, I can stand for any questions, and I thank you.
Thank you, Director. Further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Jason Riddle, RITTAL, standing in support of Senate Bill 54 on behalf of the Montana Association of Counties. For a lot of the reasons that the director and the sponsor said, for local governments, this is about some certainty, getting it correct for the taxpayer so that when we budget, we use the right numbers and we don't end up with a pot of money on hold that we don't know whether or not we're going to get to use all of it, some of it, or none of it. And that causes a great deal of strain on our local governments as we plan for the next year and how we develop what we're going to assess for mill levies for the rest of our taxpayers. Centrally assessed properties are big taxpayers. They have a large impact on our budgets. Having this extra year for the department to get these right is critical to us. We've been looking for a solution to this problem so that we don't get caught unawares of protests that come after we've set our budgets, which certainly impact our ability to deliver services. I want to thank the director for bringing this, for involving us in the upfront discussions on what this would look like and how it would impact counties. We stand in strong support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Bob Story, STORY, Montana Taxpayers Association. We support this also. A lot of our members are these centrally assessed companies. We also have a lot of counties and cities who are members also. And, you know, again, back to stability in the system, trying to figure out what you actually owe in taxes, accurate assessment, accurate valuation. People that use those tax revenues know what's coming also. So we think this is a good process. We've worked for several years to try to get something similar to this going. It's nice now the department is taking the lead on this and moving down this road of, again, working with taxpayers, just like the last bill you saw, two bills, working with taxpayers to try to get a good system going of how you value these properties. Because everyone needs to pay taxes. It's just nobody wants to pay more than they should be paying.
Thank you, Mr. Story. Further proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shelby DeMars, that's DEMARS, here today on behalf of the Montana Association of Oil, Gas, and Coal Counties. Our members are predominantly those counties that have oil, gas, and coal development, and as such, they have a lot of these centrally assessed facilities, properties in their counties. And what Mr. Riddle brought up is exactly correct. We have instances where something gets challenged and then those funds are set aside and they're not accessible. And so what we think that this bill does is creates a kind of an evening effect, makes sure that we're doing everything we can to ensure the accuracy of those tax figures from the get-go. And we would really encourage your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Alan Olson. That's O-L-S-O-N. I'm the executive director of the Montana Petroleum Association. And as you've heard, this appraisal process is very complicated. We would definitely appreciate the extra time to review the appraisals that come out of the Department of Revenue. We really do not like protesting taxes. Our employees go to public schools. We rely on local emergency services. And if we can have the extra time to review the appraisals, that could drastically cut down on protests on taxes. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I hope this committee can vote everything out. Thanks.
Thank you. Further proponents?
morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mark Lambrecht, L-A-M-B-R-E-C-H-T, on behalf of the Montana Electric Cooperatives Association, representing 25 electric cooperatives across the state of Montana. Certainly support this bill as we have centrally assessed taxes on our electricity infrastructure. Wanted to recognize the sponsor for the amendment that he described that provided additional time to answer the appraisal notices. I was advised of a couple of instances where in our small electric cooperatives, the notice didn't arrive to the appropriate person in time. And so just this helps avoid that situation where there might be a delay. So I encourage you to make a due pass recommendation on the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Wade, W-A-D-E, here on behalf of the Montana Chamber of Commerce. You've already heard all the great reasons why this is a good bill, and we just want to go on record and convey our support.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? Proponents in the room? Do we have any proponents online, please?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have opponents in the room? Opponents in the room? Opponents online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Informational witnesses in the room?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jared Isom, I-S-O-M. I'm an economist with the Department of Revenue, and I put together the estimates, CC, and the fiscal note, and I'm here to answer your questions on that.
Thank you, Mr. Isom. Further informational witnesses in the room? Seeing none, do we have any informational witnesses online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Konar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to start with Ms. Director Beatty, if I might. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Beatty. I wanted to follow up on that last part of your testimony where you talked about protesting 80%. Well, there was a bill quite a number of years ago that allowed for dispersion of most of the protested taxes to the local government. Can you go through what that process is? Because I wouldn't want the committee to think that that local government doesn't use some of the protested taxes.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Konar, sure. And I'm, if it's okay, I'll keep it fairly high level because I don't want to get into too much detail without the detail in front of me. Yes, even when a taxpayer protests any percentage of their money and they put that in the protest fund, a county or a local taxing jurisdiction can access that money. They do that at their own peril. So if the Department of Revenue's appraisal is ultimately proven wrong in court, the county has to pay their share back, and then the state general fund also has a piece of that. And the exact percentage I don't recall off the top of my head, Representative. But the money can be used, but if it ultimately turns out that you were using somebody else's money, the taxpayers pay it back. And sometimes that could be with a special levy at the county level. Some counties might be able to handle that. Certain counties that are heavily dependent on maybe one of these big central assessed taxpayers, the levy to pay back an egregious mistake by my department might leave a pretty good mark. So that's why we're proposing this, is to try to avoid as many of those marks as we can get.
Thank you. Can I have a follow-up question for Mr. Riddle? Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Riddle, I just wanted to follow up on that because I remember some percentages actually in that bill for being able to be used by local government at the time. And if you could give us kind of an idea about what that looks like on the ground and about how much the counties are using from those protested amounts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so in practical circumstances, it depends on risk, right? The amount of that's protested and the amount that is at risk that we may have to pay back if we were to spend it. Our recommendation would be to not spend those dollars or spend a minimal amount. If we're talking a protest of, you know, 20 grand, you know, maybe they take that risk. But a lot of these are significant amounts of money that if they were to spend it, they would have two options. One, they pay it back out of the reserves because they budgeted based on that revenue. Or in the instance of a court decision, we may be able to, and I'm not an attorney, so I don't want to go too far, but there is an allowance for us to do permissive levies for judgments.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Riddle. And the amount that goes into the protested accounts is based on what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm unsure of that. Maybe I could defer that.
Back to Mr. Beatty? Okay. I'd like to re-refer that to Mr. Beatty.
Re-refer?
Director Beatty. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Beatty. You heard the question.
Let's do it again, if it's okay with you, Representative. Yeah. That way I know for sure what I'm answering.
Okay. The amount of money that goes into a protested account at the local government level, what is that number based on?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Cohenhauer, often it is based on the difference between what they think they should owe and what we think the appraisal says said they should owe. Now, there's a limitation on there that I think went in with that last bill you were talking about, that, and its exact number I don't recall. But so that's really what it's based on, is I say I owe this much, you say I owe that much, we're gonna protest this much. Now, that bill went a long way, because in that 80% example I gave you, it was Thompson Falls. It was Knox and Rapids Dam, and it was 80% of a huge percentage of their money. And that bill you're talking about went a long ways to preventing that disaster from happening twice, because by anybody's definition, that was a wreck, and that happened to be, I happened to live through that.
I did too. I just want to let you know, Mr. Chair, and that's what I wanted to get at from the director, was that it's not the full amount of the taxes that are owed that goes into these protest accounts. It's a portion of it that is under discussion between the taxpayer and the department. So it's...
That's correct, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Cohenhauer. It's the delta.
Yeah,
between,
it's the difference.
Between. But when there's a big delta, it's a big delta.
Yeah. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Fearn.
Yes, for Mr. Beatty. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here, Director Beatty. My question is, let's take an average 10-year period of time. How many appeals are there that end up going to court? And what do you think the average cost to the state is on such large appeals?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Fearn, it's going to be a little bit of a flyer here, because it kind of depends on the situation. We had it in the late 90s through a good run of the 2000s. We had in court or at the state tax appeal board level probably 4 to 5 going at a time. But then what happens is, of course, these things take time, discovery, et cetera. Now you have year after year building on each other. So they protested in 2001, and then the 2002 year comes along, and that's protested. The 2003 year comes along. And the good example of that, which is why it's hard to quantify, the PPL case that I was talking about with the Thompson Falls started in 1999 and ultimately was disposed of, I think, in 2009. And meanwhile, the whole time, there's money being put in the protest fund, because a lot of that was based on the same allegedly wrong appraisal. Thank God I won it. If you wanted to call each year a different case, there's been 10 to 20 at a time. Now, those have narrowed down. We've done better at arriving at better valuations, and so there's fewer now. But if you're the county that has a big one, one's too many.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Director Beatty. And the role of the State Tax Appeal Board in looking at their role, are they often able to mitigate the problem to avoid this? You know, if you were looking at, again, average numbers that head over to the appeal board, I guess you'd say success rate as far as it stops there, they figured it out.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Fern, in my experience, once it's hit the State Tax Appeal Board and it goes through, everybody's pretty well entered up, and they're going on. Now, we have had cases that have been decided by the State Tax Appeal Board, and then we ultimately settled as they went into district court or the Supreme Court. But a lot of times, from both sides' standpoint, by the time you've actually had the trial at the State Tax Appeal Board level, the vast majority of the money spent on litigation has already been spent. So once you're entered up in the fight, most everybody wants to go to the end, as does the state, as have directors I represented. So it's both sides of the pancake are ready to go. And so the State Tax Appeal Board is, in these big cases like this, is rarely the end of the line.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Thane, Vice Chair Thane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Isom, please.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Thane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Isom, taking a look at the fiscal note, there's approximately $1 million impact, and that's reflective of the amounts that go for the 95 mills for equalization and the 6 mills for the university system. The question I have is related to item number 7 on page 2, which says there may be initial fiscal impact to local governments, but those would be recouped in the subsequent year. And what I'm thinking is that there may actually be some lost revenue in that the property's assessed, taxes are based on that assessment. Under the current plan, they would be assessed again the second year of the cycle, and there would likely be some additional revenue generated. Then when you get to the second year out, assessed again, and there would be additional revenue. Under the new plan, when it's reassessed, you don't get that mid-year bump, but you get it only in the second year, and I don't believe it actually makes up the difference to what may have been lost in the first year. So could you just walk us through that, please,
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Thane. So you're going to want to look at that first table there. It's probably going to be most helpful. You are correct. In the off year in which half of the centrally assessed properties are not appraised, there is a taxable value difference, and that's what you see in that table there. And that taxable value difference is missed in that year that it's not valued. And then the next year, we value it for the year that it wasn't valued and the next year. So then you see those zeros in that table are when we make it up. But yes, in the off year, there will be taxable value differences that aren't necessarily backfilled or anything like that. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. May I follow up with another witness, please, for a moment?
Follow up.
For Mr. Riddle, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Riddle. So given the response we just had regarding the fiscal note, does that off year where you're not receiving revenue based on what would be perceived as an enhanced value of the centrally assessed property cause any concern for counties in terms of meeting their budgets, or because you're able then to set your budgets and levy those mills on other properties in the district, does that compensate, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so we've acknowledged that in the first year as we transition, we'll probably take a little bit of a hit. After that, it smooths out over time, and we're willing to trade that for more certainty in getting these valuations correctly over the long haul. We understand that there's some little bit of pain in the transition, but from there forward, we feel like we will be made whole every other year to make up for the year before, and over time, that smooths. So we are more than willing to trade one for the other in this instance, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Riddle.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I have a point of personal privilege?
Yes, Representative.
To answer the representative's question, couldn't figure out how to ask one of those guys a question and not have an opinion, but as a county commissioner, you didn't spend protest taxes because basically we were told you're personally liable. If you made a bad judgment, and you may not agree with me, but and those deltas build up. I remember the railroad protested every year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee? Further questions? Seeing none, Senator Hertz, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank the committee for a good hearing. So I think what we have here as an observation is you got a department requesting a change in valuation. The taxpayers are agreeing to that, and the counties who get the taxes are also in agreement. What we're all trying to do here is reduce the litigation costs, put some certainty into the process. Could possibly save the state taxpayers litigation funding. Some of these might be with publicly regulated utilities, who ultimately pays their legal fees, the ratepayers. So I think this is good for everybody, and good bill. Just a request a due pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 54. We'll give everyone a chance to shuffle, and we'll do a little bit of shuffling up here too.
Open the hearing on Senate Bill 123. Senator Hertz, would you like to open on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Greg Hertz again here, Senate District 6 out of Polson. Senate Bill 123, it's an act requiring that a ballot for bond elections include additional information on the ballot. And you might be wondering, why do we need this? Well, particularly in schools, and it's in counties, it's not required. I was shocked. We had a pretty significant school bond issue in Lake County, and it was a large one, $40 million. They did an excellent job, the schools did, in educating the public as to this is the impact on a $100,000, $200,000 home. But when I got my ballot, I was like, that language is not on my ballot. It's like, really? So I got involved, called the county elections clerk, and I said, why isn't the language on there? Well, they did some research, and bond counsel got back to me and said, well, it's not required, Senator Hertz. I go, oh, interesting. It's up to the schools. Most schools do it, and most counties do it. So I just thought, well, if let's just require this, and that's all the bill does. So, and then you've also heard from Representative Hinkle. He has a similar bill, and I've been working with Megan on that, and trying to make sure our bills match up, or one of them might disappear, or we amend them and coordinate them. So, you've heard this issue already. So, I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time on it, but. The first new section applies to counties, so homes valued at 100, 300, and 600,000, you need to provide what additional property taxes those homes might be imposed in the first year on that. Kind of moved up those valuations a little bit, as we all know, property's going up. left $100,000 in there for those of us who like to do math, and you can kind of figure out, if you know the value of your house, what you actually might pay. And then down in the section two is where the schools are, and you know, you can see on line 17, school district shall put that information in there. Same type of information. And I'm also working with Megan and bond counsel on a couple of amendments. Looks like it makes sense to make this effective 1/1/24. There's a little bit other language in here on section one, replacing language with a statement. They're basically, we say an estimate, because when you're basically estimating what the impact might be on a home, you know, you really don't know what the taxable value is going to be. So you're just going to use the best information that you have available. So I think it's another good common sense bill, provides our property taxpayers with more information when they go to the ballot. So that, we'll sit down, Mr. Chair, and we have proponents and opponents.
Thank you, Senator Hertz. Are there proponents in the room?
Mr. Chairman, members, again, Jason Riddle, RITTAL, on behalf of the Montana Association of Counties, in support of Senate Bill 123. Simply put, this is a good policy change and update. I think that the giving the taxpayers more information as they vote is a valuable tool, and we would absolutely stand in support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Riddle. Other proponents in the room, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Daryl James, that's D-A-R-R-Y-L. James is the common spelling. I'm the executive director for the Montana Infrastructure Coalition. Mr. Chair, members, in light of the conversation that we've been having over the last couple of years about taxpayer fatigue, particularly property taxpayers thinking that their taxes are growing out of control, we think this is a good transparency measure, just to remind the taxpayers of what the decision what the decision before them is and what that potential impact is on their property tax bill. We think it's a great measure and stand in full support and encourage you to move this along. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. James. Other proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Reisig, last name is spelled R-E-I-S-I-G. I'm the executive director of the Montana Quality Education Coalition. But today I stand on behalf of the Coalition of Advocates for Montana's Public Schools. That includes the Montana School Boards Association, School Administrators of Montana, the Montana Rural Education Association, the Montana Association of School Business Officials, and of course MQEC, to offer our collective support for Senate Bill 123. The Coalition has great respect for the bill's sponsor and thank him for bringing this bill forward. SB 123 will provide for increased transparency on bond election ballot questions by requiring a statement to be included on the ballot to the realistic financial impact of the election outcome on a residence. As such, SB 123 will enhance voter awareness on the ramifications involved in the outcome of a bond election question that may increase a homeowner's taxes. SB 123 passed through the Senate Taxation Committee and multiple readings on the Senate floor without a no vote ever recorded. SB 123 is a good bill for Montana voters. Please support SB 123. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Reisig. Other proponents in the room? Seeing none, are there proponents online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there opponents in the room? Seeing none, are there opponents online? Seeing none, are there informational witnesses in the room? Seeing none, are there informational witnesses online?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Malone.
For the sponsor, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Vice Chair, whoever's up there.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator. This says schools. Are other bond county bond elections have the same language, or why did you stop at schools if they don't?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it doesn't. It includes counties and schools. So Section 1 applies to counties. Section 2 applies to schools. The new Section 1, it will be codified in Title 13, which pulls it into, that's according to Ms. Moore, into the local government section of the code.
Thank you for that correction, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? If not, I do have one question for the bill sponsor, please. You referenced a bill we saw previously, and I'll ask basically the same question I asked at that time. There's an addition for the assessed values to be listed at $100,000, $300,000, and $600,000. Would it not be simpler to include only $100,000 and ask that the homeowner be able to do the math? For every $100,000 of value, the tax impact would be X.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, I think some of our taxpayers are math challenged, and some are not. So I've had this discussion, and I think the consensus was around 100, 300, and 600. Another discussion that has also been floated by bond council is, hey, let's use 100 and 300 and let the local jurisdiction determine, throw in a third one, which is the average of that particular jurisdiction. Yeah, that might work too, but I don't know. It seems like, this came through the Senate without a no vote, so I think everybody kind of feels comfortable with where we're at. There's a lot of ways to skin a cat, and I think we might have the best consensus right now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Hertz, would you like to close on your bill?
Yes, I would. And so if you will let this bill marinate a little bit, I'll work with Megan and Representative Hinkle and see if we can come to a consensus here on as we move forward, Mr. Chair. So, and then on my other two bills, they're ready to move without any amendments. So appreciate if you could get those out of here also. And with that, I will close. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hertz. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 123. Members of the committee, just a quick reminder, staff would ask that you consider cleaning out your folders. They're becoming excessive, and it's a bit of a problem for them to carry and to store, so they would appreciate any assistance you could provide in that regard. With that, we'll adjourn the meeting, and we'll reconvene tomorrow at 1 o'clock, or excuse me, at 9 o'clock. With regard to the previous discussion by the Vice Chair, we will plan to meet tomorrow. We will have five bills. We'll then come back on Monday morning to conduct executive action on a number of bills that we have stacked up. We anticipate hearings on Tuesday and then being on the floor Wednesday for House Bill 2. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.